Oh, good man, how are you? Any different than what you got here? Tucker Brown ever call you? He asked me for your number. He was the chairman of the Shellfish Advisory Committee. What did he get home from? Good morning. Oh, okay. I'm going to ask you for an update on that when we get to that part of how the seed looking in your comic and cone, so how that's coming along. It'll be big enough by next fall.
I know they couldn't see him during the fall.
The size of your butt.
I'm glad it was. better place.
The further they start off, the different way they are.
Hey.
Yeah.
I know.
What we did with 100 houses.
You froze that problem, wasn't you? It's amazing what you get used to.
Almost through there last week.
I think we're just waiting on maybe Don Porter, and I'm not sure if Dan's on the line yet, but they said they might be a little late, so I think we could, if you want, I think we can go ahead and get started there.
I'd like to call the January 2020 SMAC meeting to order, and thank you all for being here. I guess I'm going to turn this over to Andrew. He wanted to, I think, go down the members here and kind of get their feelings on the orchard season and the industry and private and public, find out their feelings on it this year.
Yeah, I think just while we're still kind of fresh in our heads, go over that before we get into the agenda, just if there's any thoughts folks want to share on how the season was. I know it's not over yet. We still have February and James River seed there and everything else, but while it's fresh, I thought that might be a good opportunity for folks here while we go looking forward.
We'll start down at the end there. If you have any comments on this year's season.
Very wild one.
We can do introductions too while we're going down the line, just for the record.
Richard Harding, Greenville. Seemed to start off worried about not having enough, and wind up having more than expected. So, that's all I have to say.
Tommy Kellum, Seafood Wings, and I echo Richard's comments.
Ben Johnson, Johnson & Son Seafood, and what's his name?
John DeMaria, DeMaria Seafood. It started off really good. We have some really good customers buying more oysters than we've had to have buying quantities that I've never seen. But as soon as Texas opened up, that cut off like a switch. But we're just kind of plugging along right now, and we've got more oysters than we could sell. But maybe when Texas closes, we'll be able to jump right in and see what we were doing before. I'm done.
Cody Metcalf, I'm with the Ballard Fish and Oyster Company, Eastern Shore, Virginia. Say the same thing. It started off strong, and then definitely more supply than demand now.
Wayne France, Commercial Waterman, and because of where I am geographically, I worked in the Potomac River this year, which is open to all Virginia watermen. But it was a pleasant surprise. I mean, it beats driving to the Rappahannock and down this way. And, the results were about the same as Virginia. We did good.
Yeah. J.C. Hudgens from Matthews, Virginia. And I made a decision this year to crab longer than I normally do. I crab potted till 1st of November, simply because we didn't have a scrape season for October in the Rappahannock River. And, that Ernie addressed the Pat Dome part of it, because he worked on that and plus Deep Rock. I got my Pat Dome rig in. I switched over from a scrape rig to a Pat Dome rig. And I've worked Deep Rock some. I was a little disappointed, to say the least, what we've been able to do there. I mean, you can still make a day's work there. Ernie does good, but it's a different animal, I found that out, and it takes a different thought process than it does dredging, I tell you. And but I think the Fandonga did good in October, November, but the scrape guys, I wasn't in a hurry to start because it just, the reports I was getting, it just wasn't that great about, you know, in area 2 and area 4.
Ed Ledford with Pleasure House Oysters on the Lead Haven, and I can only say that the water stayed warm for a long time this year. We had warm water up until just, I don't know, seems like yesterday, but now...
Still 43, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that meant that a lot of the oysters grew a lot larger mm-hmm. than they would have otherwise, and if it wasn't for the rain, we're closed right now, the 10-day closure that we got last Tuesday from the rain. We'd be harvesting, you know, all the time. Like you say, we've got more customers than we have oysters, though, in the Lead Haven right now.
That's a good problem.
So y'all have to send me some.
Hey, George, the waterman on the Rappahannock. I think it's been a fairly good year. I mean, we lost a lot of oysters in the bay. That dog, I don't know what happened out there, but all the big ones pretty much died. But other than that, the boys are still, the ones that work, still make a day's work. It's been pretty good. I don't know what next month's going to bring, but we'll mm-hmm. see.
Jackie Shannon with Chesapeake Bay Foundation. Since I work as restoration focused, can't really speak on the harvesting season. One of the only things that really wasn't status quo for us this season was larvae. It was difficult getting larvae for our programs, but we got through it working with the hatchery on the Eastern Shore, and have just noticed higher than expected fat set in the areas that we're working.
All right. Thanks for that. I think that'll. It sounds like it's a problem of more oysters than anticipated, which I guess is, in the grand scheme of things, a good idea. Looks like we got Dan there on the line.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Did you hear that question there, Dan? If you want to say hi and say what you thought of the season so far.
Dan Dallas, I'm here. It's been a little better than expected as far as oyster goes, but as you can see, out of the market's a little crazy.
I gotcha. All right. Thanks for that. You want
to? As we go through this, if anybody has any questions or anything they'd like to add to the discussion, just raise your hand. You'll be noticed. And I'll turn it back over to Andrew, and we'll go right on.
All righty. So the first item on the agenda there is, I think, the last two advisory committee meetings. We discussed that starting this October, we intend to require that all oyster harvest reporting be mandatory online only. It's sort of a transition that we'd like to eventually work into other fisheries, but the oyster fishery being a single species is a good place to start. There's a couple advantages that will be both for the agency and for the industry as a whole in terms of online reporting. You can report the same day. You don't have to wait until the end of the month to do all your reports at once. So you can sort of report as you go along. It allows us to have updated harvest records sooner. So right now there's close to a 2-month lag with the paper reporting. So our harvest information isn't as up to date as it could be. And the better harvest information actually helps protect industry in terms of if there's a disease outbreak or anything like that. The FDA and the National Shellfish Sanitation Program actually does a risk assessment per serving. So the more accurate our numbers are, they have a more accurate risk assessment. So if there is actually any kind of Vibrio vulnificus or Vibrio outbreak or anything like that, it actually allows sort of a level of protection if we have accurate reporting. And online reporting really helps with that accuracy and that ease. So there really is sort of that urge to make that transition to it, both for the benefits to the industry and to the agency in terms of having more updated information there. And I guess we've come to ask Mac a couple times and asked if there was any input or concerns about that. And so far it's been relatively positive, but we're still planning on starting in April or late spring, early summer of this year, making that regulatory change starting in October 2020 for both the public and private oyster fishery, that it'll be a mandatory online reporting. And I'd be glad to answer any questions on that if there are any. But that's sort of the current plan right now.
My only question would be, and I don't know if you can answer this, but maybe staff can. Is this something that in the future maybe all the fisheries are going to be made mandatory for crabs and fish and
so
everything else?
The idea was to start with oysters because you had one species. It was the easiest transition. The next one coming around the horn in March 2021, we're going to look at the feasibility based on the feedback from the oyster industry about getting blue crabs online. And that's almost 60-70% of all our records there if we get blue crabs and oysters. Mm-hmm. You can imagine something like a gill net or a pound net, you're talking maybe 10, 12 species in a net. It can be a little more cumbersome, but the goal is within 5 years ago, all mandatory online. So that's kind of our long-term goal is 3 to 5 years for everything. Hopefully in the next 2 years, oysters and blue crabs.
Thank you. I ain't got nothing to do with it, but I know some of the older watermen, you're going to have a time.
Oyster training right now is done online, so you do have access to it. They can walk in the front door here, and we're happy to walk them through it. They can go to a local library. We will have agents out in the field offices during set times that they can walk into those field offices and do that. And if there's a buyer or something like that that has a lot of watermen there, we're also willing to do that for a period of time to really help this transition and make it successful. We realize that is going to be one of the biggest.
It's not simple because I was.
It's going to be one of the bigger hurdles.
Straight.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Agreed. It is a hurdle, and we're going to have to either do that hurdle now or in the future.
And I know some of the older ones.
Yeah.
Problems.
I mean, I like it. I've been doing it probably for about 5 years. I don't report every day. You know, I've got a smartphone, but I just got in the habit of doing it around the second or third of each month following the end of the month, you know. And like I say, oysters is very simple. Just change the amount that you caught and the day that you caught it, and that's it. And you can go on to another day and just click, 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 click as fast as you can do it. Like I said, crabbing's a little more complicated, depending on the species, you know, how you're selling your crab catch, you know. You might have, 5-inch males, you might have, you know. Well, one thing that makes it simple is the cushion crabs. They're combined with the females, so that eliminates two categories, only has one. So, it's not difficult, you know. Once you set up the first day, that's what takes the most time. And then it goes pretty smooth. Everything is auto filled to a certain extent, you know. I like it.
I agree. I just think.
Sorry.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, on the private ground, I'll put in a thing with agriculture just for the end of the month for the whole month. I assume that's going to be the same thing with what you've got going.
Yep.
On private.
It'll be monthly reporting, but it'll still be online.
On private, you just on public, you want to have know what they do each and every day.
Correct.
I agree. You know, every oysterman has to go online to take this health department thing, so you can get your license. And you know, it's just a matter of doing it, and then a couple of weeks getting used to it. And after somebody gets used to it, I think it won't be a problem.
Well, we want to make sure it's still on your radar. We plan on going in front of the commission this spring so that everyone has full notice that it will be in there for October. Everyone who has an oyster user fee got sent a flyer with their renewal letter to start making people aware. So we are going to do a boots on the ground campaign. What we're looking for you, not to bog down tonight's meeting, but if you have suggestions or some ideas for maybe this transition plan, contact staff. You know, anything we can do to try and make this successful, we're really kind of looking for some input from.
You want the oysterman to be as proficient as doing stuff on the computers as the administrators are at BMRC.
Well, it's actually, when you do a paper report and you have a box in front of you, you can write anything in that box. When you start going online and all of a sudden you choose a specific gear or yours only has certain gear licenses, the mousetrap starts narrowing you down, so as you enter it online, it's actually more accurate than them being able to write anything they want in the box. We get a lot of reports on here that people fish on rocks that aren't open, they're using gears they don't have licenses for, that, I mean, you name it, they write it down. So it actually gets
it's less staff time to correct errors, and it's actually a little bit more accurate in that manner.
I might be getting ahead of the game, but is there a mobile app for this?
Yes, it's a mobile app. You can do it on your smartphone. You can do it on a tablet, laptop.
Mobile app right now?
Yep. You can do it right. You can do it. You can sign up and do it right now.
I'll tell you one thing I like too, they changed probably a year ago, was your password. It used to be 90 days when I first started doing it, and now it's a year. So when you put your password in, it's good for a year, so that's
that's the kind of feedback we're looking for to try and make this a better transition. Uh-huh. That is something that we've heard, and we tried to make better, and as JC said, it's gotten a lot better.
Yeah, you got to change your password every year. Oh, you do change one number.
Don't tell anyone
that. It makes it a whole lot easier.
So, again, not to bog down tonight, but if you do have some ideas for transitioning or anything that you find bothersome as you're going through the process of doing it, let us know, because we want to try and make this successful, because it is kind of the pilot for future species as we go through this.
And just a little story. I may have told it before, but I did one time I was doing my crab report, and I had like 440 pounds. And so, but instead of clicking and entering pounds, I entered bushels by mistake. And they called me, they caught it down here, and they called me and said, Mr. Hutchins says, daggone, you ain't catch a lot of crabs. They said, for 85 licenses, I had 440 bushels.
And it speeds everything up. As soon as you hit submit, it flags us for it right away versus So I appreciate your time tonight, and if you have any questions, any comments, anything for the transition plan, please let us know. All
right. I guess I wanted to let everyone know what another advisory committee has been working on. I think we went over a little bit of this the last meeting, the Aquaculture Management Advisory Committee. If it gets into any particularly detailed questions on what's going on there, I might turn to Ben Stagg here, who's been taking the lead on the Aquaculture Management Advisory Committee. But I wanted to make this group aware of what was going on, as staff understands that there's a considerable amount of overlap between SMAC members and the Aquaculture Management Advisory Committee, including membership. Beverly sits on that committee as well. I believe at the last meeting we discussed that there had been some recent lease renewal or lease application fee increases by code, and that was news to some SMAC members. There's been a regulatory addition regarding the lease renewals or the lease application fees and lease renewal fees. But currently, AMAC is working on a guideline document that outlines the process for oyster ground renewals. So, currently, the intent of the guideline document is to basically outline transparently what VMRC staff will be looking at when they're looking at your 10-year lease renewals. There was a code change that went into effect last year that sort of required that VMRC look a little more closely than we have been and take other things into consideration when renewing oyster leases. And basically what this guidance document does is it just outlines the code section as written and sort of gets into a little more detail of what VMRC staff will be looking at when they're renewing leased oyster ground. So it's really an intent to make both staff's job easier, saying these are sort of automatic renewals. So there's a minimum harvest requirement, a minimum shell planting requirement for automatic renewals. So if you have, it's a very low bar. For example, if right now we're looking at these guidelines saying that if there's one bushel of harvest per acre per year on your lease, that we can look at that relatively easily in mandatory reporting, and that's a pretty much automatic renewal there. Once you get sort of past the sort of couple checkpoints there, so if there's a shell planting requirement and you're planting at least a bushel of shell per acre and you're not harvesting, that's an automatic renewal. There's still everything else listed in code there that, you know, is sort of an exception to this, but sort of those first bite of the apple, well, if you will, sort of will allow staff to quickly sort leases that may need sort of further look into. So it's a way of saying, this is what you need to let VMRC know you're doing when you're putting in your lease renewal. If you're not doing any of these things that are obvious that we can quickly check, let us know about all these other things. So it's an intent to let industry know, here's what we're going to be looking at, and these are the top priority things that will automatically make the renewal process easier. So the intent is to be transparent and also to look for an opportunity if people really aren't using an oyster lease in any way for the propagation of oysters as required by code, that we have an opportunity to find that out, look at it, address it in a fair and transparent way, and consider not renewing that lease to allow room for industry growth and expansion. And that's really the intent, is to not take anything away from anybody who's actually using it, but to allow an opportunity for growth in the industry with the level of leasing and lease applications that we currently have. So it's an intent to be clear, transparent, and allow room for growth is sort of how we're looking at it at a staff level and the intent of these guidelines. And I'd be glad to try to answer any questions on that, or if there's other questions that Ben can answer, he's here as well.
How did we get to the level of one bushel per acre per year? I guess I'm trying to get in my mind, does that really deter anyone from
it's basically the code is pretty vague in terms of it considers reasonable planting or harvest of oysters, and we more or less looked at that as what it was sort of staff's opinion that that would be at least reasonable, and we sort of did the numbers running on that, and then actually, believe it or not, about, what was it, close to 60% of oyster leases don't meet that minimum requirement, as low as it is, based on current reporting anyway. So maybe the reporting wasn't as accurate, or whatever the case was, but that's sort of what staff considered was a reasonable level, and is so low that, you know, I mean, basically anyone who's using their lease, that's literally one bushel of oysters a year for an entire acre. And if you're not at least planting that shell or harvesting, I don't think anything less than that could be considered reasonable use.
How many acres of private ground are in the state, Mr. Stagg?
How many acres of private ground?
At the moment, it's about 134,300. We're about 700 acres short of the record amount we've ever leased.
What was that amount again?
134,300.
And how many bushels was the private harvest last year?
That's actually the next slide there. It was in the 2018-19 season, it was just a little under 300,000 there. So we're at 280,000 or so. But it's sort of been in that 280 to just under 400,000 range for a number of years now.
How many acres of public?
How many acres of public ground?
Yeah.
That are open to harvest or in total? There's 240,000 acres, roughly, of public baler ground. Yep. And about 75,000 acres are in any rotation in any one year.
And there was...
I thought it was more than that.
So there was less public harvest on more acres?
It's sort of hard to compare apples to apples, but... there was a little bit less than, there was more public harvest per acre if you go 75,000 per year. If you go 240,000, it's about a bushel per acre per year. But there's also considerably more shell planting per acre per year that would count towards that equation if you're doing public to private. I mean, you plant roughly 500 to 600,000 bushels of shell per year, so that would count towards that if you were looking at public as a comparison to private. So it's relatively low compared to the effort on private ground and relatively low compared to the effort of both harvest and planting on public ground. So it's lower than the public ground production standards, and it's lower than the current private ground production standards on average. So it's a very low bar no matter how you look at it, either public or private use. But it's at least a minimum bar that staff felt, based on sort of that comparison that we all just sort of did in our heads, was at least could be considered reasonable use just on that planting standard.
Does the staff see any structure where we'll have a formal reporting for
seed and shell planting like we have for harvest?
Was your question?
Do you see a situation where we'll move towards a formal system for plant for reporting planting of shells and seed?
I don't know. I'd have a crystal ball. That's a hard one to say. I understand why you're asking that question, because it looks like that's what we're leading into here. We know you're mandatory harvesting. And like Andrew said, if you meet the one bushel per acre per year, then you're renewed, even if you didn't plant anything. Although we do try to address that a little bit in this document to say, if you don't plant on the private lease at all and you meet the requirement, we might not renew your lease, because the code says you're supposed to plant on your
And that's where I'm going, is actually tighten it up rather than relax. I mean, I'm not being critical.
So at the moment, I don't foresee us immediately going to that requirement, but certainly we're trying to get some information about that when you send in your tenure renewal. Because if you don't have a lot of harvest, but you've done a lot of planting of seed or shell or culture, whatever, combining those can still get you over the threshold to keep the lease.
I got one thing I'd like to say about that. That was I planted 100,000 bushels was year before last from Morsehead over to different pieces of ground. And when I was filing the reports in, there was some problems. They just couldn't get it through their head that I was harvest oysters from one ground and then planted on another piece of ground. And they said it was just a wash. That I needed to keep track of that myself. They weren't interested in for me to show that I take from one ground and plant off, put it in another. You know what I'm talking about?
Well, sure. So mandatory reporting captures harvest. That's the final harvest.
Okay. Well, I'd like to keep track of everything that I plant, so I can tell from a.
Absolutely, and I recommend that under the current law changes, because that's what you need to put on a tenure renewal. You could have a lease you never harvest market oysters off of, because it's not conducive to that. It's a good growing seed, and you transplant them. But keep those records, because when you send your 10-year renewal in, that's what I need to know. And it can be seed, and I got a question today, and I know it's hard. It's hard for us. Everything on the form says bushels and numbers, and we're saying a bushel of effort per acre. Well, seed, I don't count a bushel of seed as a true bushel. I mean, that's way more than a bushel of potential.
I didn't explain myself very correctly to you, I don't believe, because I caught seed on one piece of ground, and I caught 100,000 bushels of seed off one piece of ground, and I took those and planted them on another piece of ground.
Right.
They don't want that information.
Well, when you say they, you mean mandatory reporting.
Excuse me, not they, you.
Yes, I do. I do.
Well, they wouldn't accept it. They didn't want to have that because they said I was...
Who is they? Because that's me.
No, I think I can...
The people that I sent the report to, they didn't...
Okay.
They said when I'm catching them off at one place and putting it on another, it's just there was a report of the amount of oysters, 100,000 here, 100,000 here. That's 200,000 the way they were looking at it. But it was not. It was 100. It was caught at one place and put back overboard. They didn't
want it
reported that.
Well, I think I've seen some of those harvest reports, and if you report the seed harvest...
You're talking about for me?
Yep. Okay. You can report your seed harvest, and you report that, and then you report your market harvest separately from another piece of ground. So you can still track your seed harvest from your private ground, and mandatory reporting should take that. We can sort of stress that out.
The point is, if you take your seed and you plant it on another piece of ground, and you're not accepting that as you will accept that a harvest will but you didn't accept that I transplanted on another piece of ground, okay? But if you don't show that seed being planted on another piece of ground, you can take that ground away from me.
Well, I think that's information that we would like to capture is that
you
transplant.
That's what you need to put on my form.
When you do your lease renewal form.
Okay, so when you, I need to keep separate. I have all the records of it.
Right.
But my intention was I wanted you guys to have it.
And they do want it.
I wanted it to be accepted in the report form, so you had documentation of it.
Do I see?
And it was not accepted.
Yeah. I think it's just the transplanting part that wasn't accepted. The harvest part should have been accepted there. But
well,
that's
correct. It was accepted.
Right.
But the point is that you've got all these charges that you want to take stuff away from people, and I want a document that I gave to you, and you're refusing to take it, and you're telling me to keep it on my own. And to me, the documented report sent to you is critical.
So, one additional comment. This subject sort of came up at AMAC, and there was a request that could people submit yearly information on their current lease. So when you pay your rent, there's actually a question at the bottom of your rent statement. It says, did you use your lease, yes or no?
We used to capture that,
but we don't anymore. There's no place in my database to put it. But we're looking at that. That's a lot of work for somebody because you're right. It's not captured in mandatory reporting because that's harvest. Mm-hmm. And we will look at that maybe on a yearly basis we could get your... I understand trying to keep those records for 10 years.
I'm looking at the stuff that you're giving me right over here.
But if you put it on your form to me, you will get credit for it, okay? I want you to understand that right there.
You have no problem sitting over here putting something with legalese that you can take something away from somebody, and then when I try to give it to you in a definitive fashion, it's not acceptable. All you want is what I harvest. You don't want what I plant.
Well, I'm telling you, I want it, and it is acceptable.
Well,
okay?
You know, I heard that one time from Showalter. Okay? And we had a meeting over here with Showalter.
I understand.
And I remember
that.
You saying, well, he may have said that, he may not have said that.
Right. Well, I'm on record and it's
okay,
on tape.
Okay, all right, Bill.
And let's not beat Mr. Showalter to death. He's already dead.
Well, you understand what I'm
saying. Well, I understand what you're saying.
I've got this stuff right here and I'm looking right at it and I'm thinking, God, I'm trying to send this in here to get protected.
Yeah, no, I think it's just that the mandatory reporting isn't set up yet to handle any of that.
Well,
so it's a separate issue that we can work through.
Put in there about this or something, because this is critical to me.
As a member of that committee, I can share with you that the discussion about the fact that a lot of people haven't kept records and their lease may come up very soon. And so there has been discussion and an opportunity for feedback on, well, if your lease is not going to be renewed for 8 years, then you know what's going to be required of you in terms of keeping records. Some people said, well, if your lease comes up 3 months after this regulation goes into effect, you may not have kept really good records in the past. Some people do, some people don't, you know, about things like shell and things that you don't have to do mandatory reporting on. So that has been a discussion, and there's also been a discussion about people who have, and almost everybody does, have multiple leases where leases are used some for rest, you know, for growing out. Some are used for, you know, having market oysters in the summer close to a landing site. And some, you know, there's multiple uses. Therefore, the discussion led it to, and I think, Ben, you'll go along with this, to saying that if you have multiple leases, there's some consideration given on the form that you say, well, this lease was used for this, which complements this other lease where something else was going on. So there's been, and if you want a copy of the proposed guidelines, I know you can get one.
Mm-hmm.
It's online, right? Or you can get one sent to you. And I think it's February the 5th. You can make comments about it. And I think the committee members would be glad to hear from members of this committee about it too. So I encourage you, as a member of that committee, to get those guidelines and look them over and make any comments, because much of what I've heard has been commented on at the meeting, and staff has been really responsive in making adjustments as we've moved along, so that it's my understanding, am I not right, Ben, that this one bushel per acre per year, if you have multiple leases and you give your overall business plan, that's taken into consideration.
Absolutely.
And we have leases, I do anyway, that in our company that are condemned. They don't do it now. They don't lease condemned now, but they did in the past, and they haven't been uncondemned, if you want to call it that. So we're still growing oysters on them, because that's what part of our mission is, and we're reporting in narrative form what we're doing on those leases, because there's no allowance, or you can't harvest because it's against health department regulations. So there's a lot more discussion still. still to be had before they're finalized. And I don't think they're going to the commission meeting, and we're having another meeting March the 9th.
Right.
So get them to take a look at them.
Well, I can appreciate everything you're saying. I'm just telling you.
Mm-hmm. I hear you.
I like to make that report. But, Ben, I know you've always told me that you know that I'm doing everything that I'm supposed to be doing. It won't be no problem. So I have never had any problems with that. But I've never seen all this stuff here.
Right.
You know, well, just legally sitting in front of me, you know. And
the reason for this is the law did change. The law did change and requires some of the things you see in there.
And we have to
address that.
Right out of your mouth 2 meetings ago, you said right there that the problems that you were having with people not paying their rent, their lease rent, and then wanting to donate to somebody else in their family so they wouldn't lose the ground. And so because of that, you raised the transfer fee to $1,000 instead of what it was. And, you know, to me, that's penalizing us people that are doing stuff legal for somebody that's doing something wrong, and I don't think that's right. And you said the meeting before that y'all were all against that. All against that raise. And I didn't like to hear that thing out of both sides of your mouth about that stuff. You're going to sit over there and penalize somebody doing stuff that they're supposed to be doing and been doing everything right by somebody doing wrong. I just don't understand how that could possibly occur.
Well, I won't give my tip for time. Let me just explain one thing that I may have said before, is that the industry was behind some of these fee increases, okay? I did not agree with the structure of the way it was done, the acreage mixes and the amounts. I thought they were a little out of whack to the way grounds leased. The majority of our leases are a certain size.
Well, what are you going
to
do about it?
Well, this was the code. I mean, this was done at the General Assembly. I'm one person. I expressed my opinion at the time that I thought the structure of it was a little bit off, and maybe the fee was $1,000 seemed like a lot to me, but that's what was settled upon, and that's what was put in the bill, and that's what the General Assembly approved, and it's now law. So at the agency, I just have to follow the current law and administer the law to best of my ability. So I guess my bottom line is if you don't agree with what was done, the General Assembly is your remedy to fix that. We didn't set these fees. The agency did not set these fees. They've always been in the code. They've always been in the code of Virginia.
Well, Andrew said right there, it's right on record, said he said right there, he said that part of the reason they did that was because people were unscrupulously using transfer to family members to stop from losing a piece of oyster ground. He said it right there. That's meeting right here. It's all on record.
Well, that's a different problem than the fee, though. Because if people can use the law to transfer ground to circumvent the 10-year renewal, it doesn't really matter what the fee is. They're going
to
do it.
To stop it.
Well, that's what this law did. That's why we have some of these rules that say when you're in the ninth year of a lease and you attempt to transfer it, you still got a year left. So you haven't come up for renewal yet. This law, we believe, the way it's written, and I believe it was the intent, was we will not transfer the ground. If you can't prove you've been using it, doesn't matter what the new guy says he's going to do. If you haven't used it, we may not transfer it. We have that option. They can keep it one more year, and they better go gangbusters and plant a bushel per acre per year or harvest or something that last year, and then maybe we'll transfer it, or maybe we won't renew it. That's not the whole purpose of this law, but that was one of the purposes. So trying to close that loophole. That was a loophole. People were doing that. Not a lot of people, but some people were transferring leases right at the end of their term because they knew, even under the old law, it wasn't going to be renewed because they hadn't done anything. And I think industry would like to get their hands on some of that ground that people are just holding on to. And again, it's a problem, but it wasn't the majority of people. There's only a few people that were circumventing that way, but there were some doing that.
Well, I mean, I can understand what you're saying, but then at the same time, I just remember you saying something about if you went back there and looked at all these people that weren't able to put a bushel of oysters for each acre they owned privately, 60% of the people that owned private ground weren't able to justify keeping that ground because they weren't planting the one bushel per acre. So you got 60% that aren't even doing it anyway.
Well, I think this gives us some authority to try to fix some of that problem. That's That's the best answer I can give you.
Well, no, I think, you know, we could go on and go on and go on.
Well, I'm just putting $1,000 an acre. How can you do that? I mean, if you could go ahead and take it away from them, regardless if the transfer was $1,000 or not, right? Because they aren't making
the threshold. You can't have an argument about the fees, either what they are or not.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
If I could just, in full transparency on this, I would make a recommendation that you broaden that committee just a little bit more to some, I know you've got traditional people that plant, but it's, I'm not really speaking, you know, public folks, but some traditional people that have a real stake in this and are a huge part of that, that number. Just a suggestion.
Absolutely.
Dr. Mann.
The origins of a lot of this come back to me, I apologize. The origins of it are actually about 30 to 32 years old. Prior to that, there was no proof of use for renewal. Around that time, VDOT got into the business of rebuilding a lot of the bridges. The Lafayette Bridge out here is a good example. Leases were changing hands in the vicinity of those because if you had a bridge rebuilt somewhere near one of your leases, the payoff that VDOT gave you to keep you out of court was a ton of money. Leases were worth speculating on. And at that point in time, I used to do the surveys around those to give the information to VDOT, and it used to pain me for the amount of taxpayers' money that was paid to people to keep these things out of court. I had a conversation with Mr. Pruitt about it, and that's when we started with proof of use. That lasted for a few months until there was this debate about, well, there's no point in me doing anything around my lease because it's all going to get killed because of DERMA. All right, so then it got pushed back into the quiet again. And it's gone backwards and forwards now for 30 years. And we recently did a run through all these debates, and of 110,000 acres, 33,977 leases, between 2013 and 2017, only 34% of those gave you any information on reported harvest. It doesn't necessarily include the things that you do for every lease, John, and I appreciate that today. I think the general purpose of what is going on here, you know, and it was an argument that I started 30 years ago, so you can blame me if you want to throw things, is how do we preserve essentially the industry that you guys represent in terms of giving you access to leases that are effectively maintained as waterfront buffers and for various other things that actually have nothing to do with the oyster industry. These leases are about letting the industry expand. They're not about, I've got $1 million house and I don't want you in front of me. All of you have been through that, okay? And I think the other part of it is the point that you made. I mean, where do you start with this? When you go back to sort of the origins of, okay, Roger, we can't do that, we have to reduce it because of DERMO and other losses, you know, and 25 years ago, those were really big deals. So the second question is what do you think is a reasonable number? I mean, one bushel shows that you are actually doing something, but in all truth, it's laughable. And so the sort of the conversation I think we have is, you know, I mean, we can argue about the fees and how the paperwork goes in and the rest of it. And that's evolving. But, you know, I sit out here and I don't have a vote. The thing that I would like to ask you guys, because this is you want to get this stuff back into the access area for the industry so that if you want to rebuild something, it's not being impeded by others who simply want to keep leases for other reasons. And when you've got 34% who report and the others who don't, that's tens of thousands of acres. Now, it may not be the best acreage, but it's tens of thousands of acres that you guys don't have access to. And at least, you know, as sort of sitting as an associate member on the outside of the oyster industry for the last 35 years, that more than irritates me a bit. And so the question becomes, how do we change this system? You don't have to use all of it, but at the moment, you're effectively excluded from the debate. And to me, if we're trying to rebuild and expand the oyster industry, that doesn't help a whole lot. So, you know, as we have this conversation, yeah, maybe we've got to fix some of the paperwork and the wording, and there are fees and things that we can't fix instantly. But
But I think the real point of this is, how do you get a lot of that stuff back so that you have access to it, rather than the current state of the renewal process, which is never going to give you access to it? That, to me, is wrong. All right, I'll shut up. Thank you, sir.
Well, I think I've almost made a career out of paraphrasing Roger, but I think the intent is to help industry, allow them to have room to expand and make what we're doing clear and transparent. So it's not a grab take back to try to limit anyone who's actually doing what they're supposed to be doing, which I believe everyone up here is. So I think the intent is to be clear, go forward, and Roger's correct that we're in the process of working through how to do this. So, yeah.
Mr. Mann, could you say that number of acres? I got the 34%. Did you have that in the number of acres that had reported?
About 110,000 acres under lease. But between 2013 and 2017, 34% of the leases reported harvest. Now, that's not exact because leases are different sizes, but in the general scheme of things, two-thirds of the stuff out there didn't report anything. So, you know, if that perpetuates, does that 34% represent 34%? Does that 60%+ represent something that you don't have access to?
No,
because of the way the renewal system works, you will never have access.
And I understand what you're saying, but to go along with what Mr. Button said about the Baylor ground, there is a large percentage of that private lease that is unproductive. Even if you own a 200-acre piece, there may only be 75 acres or 100 acres of that piece that's productive.
Right.
So you put, if you just say half is unproductive, then 34% of that half,
yeah,
it kind of changes the numbers a little bit.
Right. My concern is the stuff that potentially is good that you don't have access to because of the lease process. And that, to me, is excluding you from building your business.
I don't think that's what he's saying. What he's saying is he might have a 100-acre piece, but only 60 acres of it is suitable to propagate oysters. 30-40% of it, you wouldn't grow anything.
Right. What I'm saying is 34% by number of leases reported. Okay. The other 66%, there are no reports of any production at all. That's by number of leases, not by acres.
Okay.
So I appreciate your point, sir, and you're correct.
Well, that's something that might be worthy of addressing. I don't have that problem, but I can see, you know, like a piece of oyster ground I call Ghost has got some hard bottom in one place over there, and it's very, very productive, but you know, 60% of that oyster ground, you can't grow anything because the mud is so soft. You put a shell in it, it just sink like a china. So I don't know that there's anything that I know Ben, whenever I renew, I never have any problems and everything is fine. But I'm, you know, this doesn't address that situation that I just described.
Right. Well, that's something else that can be fixed. My concern is the stuff that you don't have access to because of the way in which it's renewed.
Well, the stuff. I mean, I don't know if anybody up here complaining about what they don't have access to. They just want to protect what they do have access to.
Well, I think we could talk about this for a whole other meeting here.
This is at least a 3-beer conversation.
So, real quickly, bottom line is, you all got a copy of it, okay? And it says draft, okay? It says draft, okay? We do want your comments. That's why we brought it to this committee as well.
Okay, well, maybe we can have some comments on that.
Tommy's got a good comment about maybe some additional representation on AMAC. But these two committees do overlap a lot, okay? We understand that.
And it wouldn't necessarily have to be a full-time committee member, just
right.
Some input on this subject, since it does cross, but
read these. If you haven't read them, read them again. If you have read them, read them again. Send us your comments. Send them to me. Send them to Andrew. Send them to somebody, Ellen. She chairs the other committee. We do want your comments. This probably won't go to the commission as a document that the commission in theory may adopt and may not. You know, it's up to them. It is a guideline document, it's not a regulation. But the current thinking by Ellen, at least Deputy Commissioner, is that we wouldn't have a commission hearing on this till probably April. So you have some time. Again, look at it. If you don't like something, If you like something, if you think something's missing or something needs to be added or taken out, send it to us. I can't guarantee you that we'll incorporate your changes, but we do it here. That's the reason we call. And try to be transparent. We're just trying to administer the law. It was changed. That's all I got to say. Thanks.
But move forward. But just as a comment, state of Maryland, if you lease bottom from the state of Maryland, don't you have to put like 10,000 oysters per acre or something like that?
I don't have the exact numbers there for other leasing systems, but the use plans and the requirements for planting are substantially higher in pretty much everywhere other than Virginia in terms of what is required of you, the cost overall. So Virginia is the least restrictive that I'm aware of any other state or county.
Of course. Most states do have use requirements. And just a little historical information. Way back when J.B. Baylor was surveying the Baylor ground, he wrote a report about the industry in Virginia. And his recommendation at the time was planting a certain amount of bushels of shell or oysters in his report. He was a pretty astute guy for having lived in the 1890s and the turn of the century. He sort of foretold things we're talking about in the last 10 years related to this law change. So he, even way back then, he thought there should be some requirement on private lease ground that there be some planting and some shelling requirements to keep the lease. He recommended that. We've never really incorporated that much into our system, but he did recommend it at the time. So nothing new under the sun.
To maybe end on a positive note, you know, Virginia is the envy of many states and their policies and their practices regarding, you know, leased bottom and aquaculture expansion and so forth, and that, you know, the fact that we're the largest producer of aquaculture oysters on the East Coast speaks to that. So I think we have some success to be modeled after as well. You know, and nobody can get it perfect, but a lot of the leases were surveyed not even considering what was possible to, in terms of their use. In other words, you might have a lease that's, as we said earlier, that's huge, but only a small portion of it is actually usable, you know, for that. And that was another thing on the other states that, you know, you're comparing apples and oranges. They're only leasing grounds that are suitable for oyster, you know, production. But I do recommend that people send their comments. That will make a difference.
All right. Are we ready to move on there to...
I believe so.
All right. You still there, Dan? You might have put us on
here.
Okay, there we go. You still have that little piece of private ground out there in the sound, so I hope that was relevant for you. But no. All right. All right. Now
you,
I get...
Go ahead. Your note, Andrew. On recording and AMAC, please, we won't ever get to ask my agenda.
All right. All right, so this takes us to the 2020 oyster restoration and replenishment plan. So this is what I'd like to do is just walk through the whole plan, if that's amenable to the group there, and then I'd be glad to answer any questions. And this is a draft plan. This will go to the commission, not this January meeting, but at the February meeting for their approval, and I'll try to incorporate any suggestions or recommendations or advice from this committee going forward. But with that, I'll go ahead and take us through the plan restoration and replenishment work in 2020. So just sort of a little background. This is the graphic that starts most of our advisory committee meetings, but this is the most recent and best harvest data that we have. It's through the 2018-19 harvest season. Public ground is seen there in blue. Private ground is seen there in orange there. And you can see that we've been relatively stable. There's been some fluctuation up and down. 2018-19, that was that season where we saw that fresh water there. And just fairly recently, I've actually gone back through some of the long-term harvest reporting information there, and the actual number of bushels coming off of public ground today are actually quite similar to the long-term average dating back really to 1957-58. So a lot of these really large numbers of millions of bushels of landed were coming primarily from private ground in this time frame. And a lot of that was, as we sort of discussed in detail there, related to extensive sea transport from public to private ground. So during the 60s and 50s in this time frame, literally, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of public seed was being transported off public ground to private ground for harvest. So that's really where you're getting these millions of bushels. And the actual harvest during much of this time frame, I mean, there were some peaks where it was getting up over 600,000 bushels from public ground. But reality, the long-term harvest amount from really 57, 58 going forward today was 257,000 bushels from public ground. And just the last five-year average has been 255,000 bushels. So in terms of long-term averages and the short-term average, since we've seen a little bit of a rebound of the public oyster fishery, the actual harvest amounts are quite similar today as they were even historically there. So really that big dip that you see in harvest numbers was primarily a result of the seed harvest not going on to private ground from public ground and that drop-off in private ground harvest, along with MSX and dermo and now bracket oyster disease and a whole other bunch of factors that went into that, but that's actually just the raw harvest data. there we go. I seem to be frozen here. I don't know what's going on. They said they were having issues with the COVA computer systems today, and I seem to be having one of those issues right now. I'm completely locked up here. Nope. There's a lovely picture of Chesapeake Bay sailing canoes there from 1905. But let's see. Let's try a quick reboot here. So during the same sort of rebound to those historic harvest numbers, there has been a measurable increase in the actual standing stock of oysters. We see that on our stock assessment surveys. But at the same time, there has been a transition to more efficient harvesting gear type, and more people have come back into the fishery. So it's not a clear comparison to say the oysters themselves recovered fully to those historic levels. They recovered somewhat, but also gear harvesting efficiency using the hand scrape as opposed to patent tongs and hand tongs, which were the dominant fishery in early days, has been responsible for a portion of that increase in public harvest. So there's not as many oysters likely today on the bottom, but we're harvesting them at more efficient rates, which has allowed us to recover to those harvest levels.
How can that be with a limit?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the patent tong days of the 70s through, 88, when patent tongers were catching 65 to, close to 75, 80 bushels apiece, and we've got a 8-bushel per man limit, how could you get that far out of whack?
In terms of the population right here?
Just your overall comment about our efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
And harvest, if whether you use hand harvest, patent tong, hand tong, dredge, scrape, 8 bushels is 8 bushels.
Mm-hmm.
So how could we be comparative to years past when you had no limit and patent tongers catching
What I'm saying is it's hard to make a direct comparison for a number of reasons, that being one of them, but you can look at the efficiency that, for example, you can catch 60 bushels in a harvest area with patentongs in terms of the density there. Like, you would quit fishing in Moratico, for example, that was recently open with the patentongs. Everyone left because there weren't any oysters there for patentongs to catch. But you could go back to that same area that same year, that same fall, and catch that limit with a hand scrape. That's all I'm saying on that. So the direct comparison is difficult to make.
So you're not making comparisons of what we're actually harvesting.
No,
saying it would be possible, which is for the reason for the limit to begin with, is that you're restricting that possibility of...
Right.
Okay,
yeah.
I'm
yeah.
sorry.
So it is difficult to compare past data, but this is sort of the best way that we can. So there is that. So there has often been this misperception on what actually public and private harvest means, and I've started putting this graphic up to sort of bring the point across that many people who, particularly some of the large industry folks who are transplanting hundreds of thousands of bushels of seed and shell every year, already know. But still, the majority of harvest annually in Virginia comes through traditional shell planting and seed movement. So this is an updated version. This is just through 2017, but you can see that of all of the harvest in that calendar year, 42% of it came from the public ground, 34% of it was caught using traditional gear types on private ground, so that's dredges, scrapes, mostly dredges and scrapes. Not very many people are using traditional hand tongs or patent tongs on private ground. And then 24%, and this is all based on the gear type and mandatory reporting, is coming from aquaculture containerized cages, bags, racks, that sort of thing. There is a portion that's hard to separate out in mandatory reporting that is hatchery based in this 34%. That's coming from spat on shell planting. There are a number of large growers that are doing spat on shell planting, probably another 10 to 15%. Could be accounted for that, but still the majority of it of harvest in Virginia is coming from traditional shell planting, natural spat set, or the transport of tens of thousands of bushels of public ground seed to private ground. So now I'm just going to give a quick rundown on where we've been the last couple of years. I'm going to try to work through this and get into the meat of where shell is being planted. Really, the whole purpose of shell planting is sort of to maintain a certain percentage of oyster ground at least a minimum amount of culture on the bottom, so volume of shells that aren't sunk into the mud. And really, the number that we shoot for is any areas that get below 5 liters of shell volume. That's live oysters and shell, brown shell that's coming out of the mud that's available for recruitment. We target those areas for replenishment. 10 liters is really ideal. There's actually just physically more room should a good spat set occur for a spat to attach to. So those are easy numbers to work with. We can measure those. Those are sort of the target areas that we shoot for. This is long-term, or this is a complete data set of all the spat in all the areas that we monitor. 120,000 some oysters counted go into this for 2016. You can see clearly that when the bottom that we're surveying doesn't have very much shell there, so less than, you know, basically there's almost no shell there, less than that 5 liter threshold, you're getting almost no spat. At 10 liters, you have basically the entire area is covered in a single layer of shell. And at that point, you have room to get really good spat sets. That's sort of how it works. There's literally just physically enough shell for the spat to attach to, and that's what we shoot for. And once you get to that point, you can actually see these really high counts. I mean, 300, 400, 800 spat per square meter, which translates to thousands of counts per bushel there, if it's an actual bushel of shell. So that's really what you're going for. That's why we want as many areas as possible to at least be meeting this minimum, and better yet, this sort of 10-liter threshold that really gives you room for a good spat set if it occurs. And this is what we saw in 2016. So generally, it followed that trend. 2017, again, keep in mind this is where we're seeing 100 spat per square meter. So the scale does change on some of these. And again, you can see 5 liters here. 10 liters was really when you can see good spat sets take off. There's literally enough room for the spat to attach. This picture is actually one of just a sample grab that we're taking, and this is what actually we're measuring to get this information there. So that was 2017. And then you can see in 2018 that it didn't really quite work out. This is, again, the scale there. So you can still see that there's that clear 5 liters and 10 liters where you get good spat sets. But there were a lot of these outliers where you were still seeing low recruitment even if there was shell available. So this was the year when there was low salinity, we were seeing a lot of that rainfall, and the areas that did get good spat sets, there were areas that were recently replenished, so that shell was available. So even in this bad year, it was still true that more or less you don't get good spat sets if there's not shell on the bottom. That's pretty self-apparent. But this was the year where there really was a below average, if you look at sort of the last 10, 12 years, spat set. Most areas, there were a few exceptions in the Tangier Sound and Lower James that still got pretty good spat sets, but most of the other tributaries in the Western Shore didn't. But you still planted a lot of shell, so that was a good thing, particularly given the 2019 spat set we saw. So with the increased replenishment funds, we were able to increase our shell plantings. We've planted more than 1 million bushels of shell on harvest areas in the 2018-2019 planting seasons, and that really was well positioned when we got the 2019 spat set that came through. It almost appeared like the oysters were saving everything up for when salinity returned to normal. So we actually saw one of the best spat sets we've seen in really recent memory, so in at least 12 years. This has been the best baywide spat set that we've ever seen on the current Patentong survey, how it's run. So we were seeing baywide averages. Again, this is that 100 spat per square meter way down here. And you can see the scale on this graph has changed all the way up to 2,500 there. Yep. Oh, okay. So it really was we were well positioned with the shell planting that we had done the last 2 years to take advantage of this. That's a reason why we should continue planting this shell, so when we do get good spat sets, we can recover, the fishery can come back in 2 to 3 years. If you stop planting shell, or if you get 2 or 3 bad years, the fishery can still kind of go the other way. We were sort of hedging our bets and had a little bit of fear about that with the rainfall we saw last year, but it really has turned around in part because all that substrate has been available for this spat set.
So what part of the year was that spat set?
In 2019, we've seen probably, based on the size that we're seeing, at least 2 recruitment events. So probably one in June, July, and then again later in the year. So not all areas, but it appears that a lot of areas got 2, or there was sort of a trickle spawn. So it was sort of continuously going most of the year, but there was a good pulse that we saw sort of in that traditional June, July time frame, and then again, a later spat set on a lot of areas. So there was, in some places, literally spat on top of spat on top of spat. When you get into these, 2,000 count per square meter, that's 2,000 spat on an area the size of this desk. So that's a good news, unless you're working a cull table in that particular area there in future years. But when you're culling a lot, it means there's something for next year. So that's a good problem to have. So that's sort of where we are going into what we're planning on doing this year. I'm going to go over our funding sources now. I just wanted to make folks aware that you're going to see a pretty big number in there. As part of the 2014 Chesapeake Bay Watershed Agreement, Virginia is a signatory of that. There's been a focus for large-scale oyster restoration. There's a lot of federal partners involved with that, sort of separate from the replenishment of public grounds. We feel that it can have added benefits, so work that can be done in these restoration areas can bring down the per unit cost for work being done on public ground areas. We're trying to work in areas that aren't going to take anything from the public fishery. You may have heard there's been some debate up in Maryland about some of their large-scale restoration programs. But all the areas that VMRC is working with federal partners on are outside of our current harvest areas. They might be adjacent to. There'll be some co-benefits, as I said, of perhaps bringing the per unit cost down. And some of the, particularly some of the funding requests for this are included in the governor's budget this year. They're not all set yet until General Assembly gets finished there. And we won't really have an official budget to start with until July 1st. But these funding amounts are sort of what we anticipate sort of the maximum amount being over this time frame. So with that, I'll go into more detail on the funding. So right now there's the last two fiscal years, we've had that recent increase in replenishment funds. So our current funding levels of general funds are $2.5 million in general funds for replenishment of public harvest areas. There was additional funds added for restoration specific funds. This has been interpreted to mean non-harvest areas, the closed areas. Again, whenever possible, we try to have co-benefits of both our harvest areas and our restoration areas, not just benefiting the specific area, but having co-benefits, adjacent areas, private ground, the general water quality improvements, and sharing a spat set. So we try to all get along in terms of where we're putting our restoration effort, where we're putting our replenishment effort, and the understanding that both are going to help the overall oyster industry. So with that, there's specifically included in this year's budget $1.5 million for general funds for restoration. This is that big number that I told everyone is still, that's a different request. It's specifically for targeted tributaries as part of the Bay program. It's a capital fund request. it's working its way through the General Assembly now. And again, there's no anticipation that we'd spend all $10 million in a single calendar year, but the intent is to include a portion of that in restoration-specific work for this year. And again, we're not sure what that amount will actually be. Department of Environmental Quality reached a settlement with a Superfund site in the Lillis River, the Eastern Branch, and VMRC is the recipient of those funds specifically for a restoration project in the Eastern Branch of the Elizabeth River. Again, whenever possible, we'll try to group restoration and replenishment work into similar contracts, so again, we can bring down the per unit cost of those and try to piggyback off and get more replenishment planting for a lower per unit cost and vice versa for restoration work. So there's that, and that's primarily going to be in the Eastern Branch. The Nature Conservancy, again, has some grant funding available primarily for, they've partnered with us on both seaside, mostly on seaside restoration work and some work in some of the restoration tributaries there. And recently the Nature Conservancy has actually provided some funding for replenishment of public grounds on the seaside of the Eastern Shore in the hand harvest areas. So that's been a good use of those funds. And then there is some non-general funds available. Most of this is oyster resource user fee money. That's $150,000, and most of that would be going on to seed transport that we'll get into later in the plan, actually next in the plan. And then it looks like we should have about $500,000 to $1.6 million in NOAA federal grants this year. That, again, is targeted mostly for large-scale restoration in these areas, and the same goes for that, and that we'll try to, whenever possible, bring the per unit cost down. So there's a lot of restoration-specific work, but not all of that funding is a sure thing, and whenever we can, we're going to try to have co-benefits to the public fishery as well as the overall restoration. So that's where the money's coming from or potentially coming from this year, and here's what we're going to be doing with it. So in the James River, the last 2 years, working with this advisory committee, we've developed a harvest rotational strategy for three Potomac tributaries, the Cone, the Nominee, and the Yukamako. The Cone was planted the first year, 2018. The Yukamako was planted last year, and this year we'll be planning on planting in the Nominee. This was, the original intent was to use seed transported from the Hantong areas of the James River, in part because of out-of-state demand and in part just other market factors. The cost of Hantong seed was prohibitively expensive, and there weren't any folks interested in doing the work When we first attempted to do it in 2018, for I believe we were offering $10 a bushel, but we were able to use a shell plant in the Mansman Bridge area that had received one of those extremely high spat sets and transport some of that seed to those two areas, as well as last year to areas in the Rappahannock River and Upper Pocomoke Sound. So again, this year we're going to plan on transporting approximately 5,000 bushels to the Potomac tributary, two areas in the upper, well, here, I'll go through the map. So here's the Nominee. These will be the likely areas that haven't been planted since 2015. And the Nominee, locally called the Cut and Deans, will be probably the areas where this seed has been will be transported to. Previous seed plants have done relatively well there. The cost-benefit return hasn't always been great, but that might have been in part because of mandatory reporting issues. And also, these areas were immediately open to harvest. So these areas would likely not be open to harvest for 2 to 3 years, depending on their size. This year, when we get into the harvest season later this year, will be the first year where one of these Potomac tribs has had a full rest time after seed planting. So we're excited to see how that's looking. So far, what we've seen the last 2 years, the seed surviving well, both in these areas and in the areas where it was transported to in the upper Rappahannock and Tangier Sound, or Pocomoke Sound. The areas in the upper Rappahannock that we'd be planting with this year, we did Maratica last year. We'll probably put a little bit more there. It's a pretty large area. The seed that we saw up there was doing very well. We did Smoky Point, Hog House, and Maratica last year, so we'll probably do a little more on Maratica, and perhaps Waterview there would be areas that didn't get phenomenal spat sets this year, but would be these are the put-and-take areas in the Rappahannock that are sort of outside the normal rotation schedule, primarily because they don't get these heavy spat sets, but putting this seed back there will hopefully give those areas a boost. I know I've had some discussion with some of the Eastern Shore crowd about Pocomoke Sound seed planting, proposing this year planting some seed in the upper Pocomoke Sound. So last year we planted some seed a little bit further down on an area known as Shell Rock that hadn't gotten a very good spat set in a number of years. The last time it had a really good spat set and had good numbers was after some Great Wicomico seed had been transported there. So the intent was to try to give that area a boost. There's been a lot of shell planting there. And the spat sets, we're not going to take credit for just the seed doing it, but they have improved in the lower Pocomoke Sound. They've been pretty good there. Both the last 2 years really have been sort of a substantially better than the previous 4 years. And last year was actually one of the better sets the lower Pocomoke Sound has seen. There was some shell planting done in 2018 in the upper Pocomoke Sound off the Saxis area, and these areas had some set this year, but these areas still had a relatively low spat set. There just aren't really very many market-sized oysters left after these areas have been open, I think, 2 or 3 times now to harvest without any replenishment effort. So it is possible that there is a recruitment issue going up there. So the intent would be on one of these areas closest to Virginia and the furthest away from the Maryland line to transport a small amount of seed. There's been some concerns about cross-border poaching, other poaching issues there. But we have planted some shell there. We haven't seen the recruitment that we'd like to. And this is a relatively cost-effective way of planting a shallow area that's hard to plant with large shell planting barges. And may give that shell that we did plant on some of the areas further down a boost in recruitment and allow for some harvest in the future in these areas. So that would be at approximately $6 a bushel is what we've been able, $6 to $7 a bushel, depending on distance, is what we've been able to do transporting seed-wise. So the Piankatank and Great Wicomico River, we've had a seed program there where private industry has been allowed to sign up for a certain number of bushels based on our standing stock assessment. We're required to plant 2 bushels back. We really haven't recovered from the low spat sets in most of these areas to levels where we're comfortable doing that on a large scale. There was is one area there in the Great Wicomico where we'd like to transport a small amount of seed from the seed areas to the hand scrape areas in the lower Great Wicomico. The Great Wicomico was an area that saw better spat set than last year, but there were still some issues there, and the recruitment hasn't been great. And again, this is one of the areas where there's not a great amount of bushels available for the private industry. Usually it's been about 30,000 bushels between the two, and we want to give it at least one more rest, probably lightly replenish those areas if we can, and then readdress the seed for shell program, probably going into next year after those areas have kind of had a little bit more of a chance to recover. But the plan would be to move some of the seed from the seed areas to the public ground. Just you can do it relatively inexpensively there. It's a short run, and that would allow some benefit from those seed areas for a larger portion of the fishery.
What happened to VA seed?
That usually good all the time. 2018 was not the greatest spat set there in the Piankatang.
Fresh water.
Probably fresh water. Even with the two bushels back, the shell base wasn't really holding its own in a lot of areas. There's some areas where it would be okay, but we don't want to knock it back too soon. It's really starting to recover right now. It's just there was that low spat set, almost no growth, and we really want to sort of have a better idea of with this good spat set that we've seen in these areas and the increased growth of those areas really bounce back, and we're not quite comfortable on a staff level of knocking them back at that level even with that shell planting. So they're well positioned right now to look at this again in the future, but having 10, 20,000 bushels of seed coming out of those areas with a limited benefit for private folks would be maybe a bit too soon. So that's what we're looking at.
I'm sorry, Andrew. I know you're on a roll, but I got a question about Great Wicomico. You're talking about taking 5,000 bushels of seed and moving it to the public area, to the area one or two. Why not blackberry?
Blackberry actually had a very good spat set and got shell planted on it this year. So we planted, 700 cubic yards. So several. Doing some math for us. Close to 1,000 bushels per acre out there, and it actually got a very good spat set this year, and there's still, based on our survey, a lot of small oysters out there. So that area got a better spat set than the Great Wicomico did.
That's just my experience in that whole area, they just grow better there than they do
in terms of blackberry. Yeah,
they just grow much better and faster there.
Well, I think we'd probably plant most of this seed on the area that'll be close to harvest next year. So the area that was just open, so we'll give it a full year at least before it comes in. It looks like blackberry, I think it was a good decision to let it rest, particularly because there were a lot of small oysters there that I know harvest, there's a 10% tolerance, but I think more than that could have disappeared from that area. And also the spat set there would get probably impacted by that, but that area does look like it should be coming on pretty strong again next year, so there isn't a need to really do anything with it right now because of the spat set and the shell planting that we've done last year.
Shell bore's been closed for what, a couple of years now?
Yeah, and that's one of the better areas, and you know, we'll be out there monitoring it pretty closely, so if it looks like 5,000 bushels is going to be too much, we close it down, but we plan on replanting that area after that seed's been removed.
I'm just staying on blackberry thing. So you're not even planning on planting shell berries?
No, we planted that area pretty well last year there. So that got it got a great spat set, both the areas that we planted and the number of small oysters that were still there. So that area should be pretty good this time around.
Do you have any room for the waterman in that $2 to move?
Yeah. No, that's sort of a ballpark there on what we think we could get for it. It's a pretty short run, but these are sort of estimates there. But we'll set the price, and if we don't get a price that we want, we can either increase it or decide to put that money into something else, sort of depending on how it goes. So most of these numbers are sort of estimates there, so we'll notice for approximately this, but if we're not getting any interest in it, we could adjust it a little bit there. But this is just for planning purposes what we'd be doing, and based on the cost that we've paid for similar work in the past.
Okay.
So that would cover the seed transport for the 2020 replenishment plan. And these numbers, again, I'll go through an overview and then a little bit more area specific. Our proposed shell plants, so depending on funding, depending on per unit cost, and what we see in some of the resurveys in the spring, we'll probably trim some of the acreages here. But again, we sort of, if you look on that table attached, the areas that are the lowest in terms of shell volume, closest to that 5-liter threshold, or that have been recently opened to harvest in this rotation, would be the areas targeted at the first sort of cut there on funding wise. And then as you get closer to that 10-liter or over, then we'd look to keep replenishing in those areas. The acreages in the lower James are probably the most flexible. That area has gotten a lot of replenishment effort recently, but there's also the most acreage to work with. So, you know, that 564 acres is probably much higher, but it could be some portion, or much higher than it actually will be. We included all of Nansman Ridge. We're not going to plant the entire Nansman Ridge, but it should be, that would be the maximum if there was a windfall of funding and we were able to plant shells everywhere we wanted to plant. This would be the maximum acreage we would plant. So just keep that in mind going forward there.
Is Deep Rock going to get anything this year?
We're looking at planting probably a little bit on Deep Rock. I did inadvertently leave that off this list here, but we're going to be in those areas, so we'd likely put a little bit there on Deep Rock as well.
Yes, Andrew, is it your opinion that if we had more money, we have room to plant more ground for public arts?
Up to a certain extent. I mean, there is a point where once the areas are there, if you're trying to expand into new areas, that's always risky business in terms of if you're planting on less than optimal areas. But right now, this is the we don't have money likely to plant all 1,100 of these acres that need it, but we're actually in better shape in terms of the shell volume based on this last survey than we have been in a number of years, in part because of that increased funding. And that allowed us to capitalize on that SPAT set. So as long as we keep replenishing at these same levels, we'll likely be able to maintain the fishery where it is. And the other flip side of that is there is a limited amount of this reef shell or fossil shell and shell available. Mm-hmm. So even with more funding, doesn't necessarily mean that you can keep planting more shell if it's not simply not there.
So essentially, as it stands right now, for replenishment on the public harvest bottom, we only have $2.5 million. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah.
And if my math is correct, it looks like it's about a total of $16 to $17 million set aside for restoration.
Well, that 10 million number is
part
sort of
it, yeah.
That's a separate fund, but right now it's really $1.5 million in terms of the comparable funds for restoration there.
I just don't see how the watermen are getting a fair shake out of this money. I tell you, it's we're really getting the short end of the stick here. Last year we had $3.5 million, didn't we?
No. Last year it was the same $2.5 million there. So actually, that's a
huge difference in amount of money. I can understand the importance of restoration. You know, some things that are being done there, but we both got to work in this fishery. You know, and I tell you, watermen are really getting the short end of the stick here on this. It's a lot of money available. We're not going to have, we're going to get very little bit of it, I tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know there's nothing you can do about it, but that's just my thoughts, you know.
And just to sort of try to ease your thinking there a little bit, I know I've been saying it a couple times there, but whenever possible, let's say there's shell planting going on at Deep Rock, and there might be some shell planting going on at Piankatank. Whenever we can, a lot of the cost of that work is mobilization that's rolled into the cost.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's already mobilized, you can get that per unit cost. So I know it looks like just dollars to dollars.
Mm-hmm.
There's more for restoration, but we'll work very hard to lower the per unit cost for replenishment. So because there's all this more money for restoration, the hope is that instead of paying whatever it is, $2.50 to $4 a bushel for shell going into replenishment harvest areas, maybe we can drop that price to $2 to $3.50 a bushel, so you're getting more for that $2.5 million, because some of that money is being paid for restoration and vice versa. So we're going to try to work that whenever we can, because staff does understand that there are co-benefits, but with this funding, it has been a little restoration specific, primarily because of that settlement request and this capital fund, which is sort of separate from the traditional public fishery. So these are, I'm including these plans just for transparency, but this is sort of a separate funding stream from maintaining the public fishery there. But whenever possible, we'll try to have co-benefits and benefit both.
Yes. Andrew, is there any concern of staff that this money is going to help decrease the supply of shells faster?
We'll get into the shell planting there, but most of this restoration fund is going to be done with alternative substrate. We might be able to use some fine shells, so most of the shell resource is going to be going to harvest areas, and most of the restoration work is going to be done with alternative substrate. We might do a little bit of work, I'll get into the plan later, on harvest ground with alternative substrate. Another benefit of, I know it's the sort of sticker shock value of the restoration work, but there is going to come a day when there isn't going to be a lot of shell available. It might come suddenly if the fossil shell rig breaks down or if the cost becomes prohibitive. And this allows us to both plant and get really good at planting this alternative substrate, come up with ideal sizes, ideal procedures. So it's, on face value, it is some sticker shock, but it will have sort of down the road benefits, we hope, to the public fishery as well. So there's that take in mind there. So these are the areas in Tangier Pocomoke Sound. Most of these areas are either on that low end of the brown shell volume, the areas that weren't open this year, in Tangier Sound. So I guess a couple areas there on Thoroughfare and California there would get planted while we're in the neighborhood there. Johnson's, again, was open this year. It's been getting worked pretty hard right now. There was a pretty good spat set there this year. We'll probably do some replenishment there. Marshalls and Bird Rock were particularly productive areas. They've been planted with fossil shell, I believe, in 2016. Some of that shell ended up sinking into the mud and just sort of off the best part of the rock there, and we were able to move that shell and some of the live oysters onto the more productive areas. We'll resurvey those areas again and make sure that we're planting these productive areas as well as any other areas that might support that. But these areas have been very good this season out in the Tangier and Pocomoke Sound. We may do a little bit of work there on Parker's in Onancock. I know Parker's hasn't been historically a great setting area, but we have seen some recent set there. And the hope is that a little more shell being available will increase that. Onancock Rock and Public Ground 11 here would likely be planted with shell. This is an area that we could use restoration funding for, and that may boost that area up, which will provide some recruitment down and, again, lower that per unit cost for shell that's going over to Tangier Sound. Great Wicomico, again, these are the areas that are either in need of shell, would have some shell removed or seed removed during the seed program there, or have been open to harvest recently. So these would be the areas in the Great Wicomico. So Shell Bar, Sandy Point, the seed areas, Cranes Creek, Fleeton, Ingrams, and Ingrams Bay there are the areas that are in need of that there. the Rappahannock, most of the areas that we planted with shell this year that are areas 2 and 4 that have been open to harvest and spike there. And the lower Rappahannock is getting the shell volume there isn't ideal, so we replenish that area whenever possible. We try to get areas that are in need or close to need when we're in the area, because, again, that mobilization cost for planting a small area isn't worth going back to that area. And then the furthest upriver is Stove Point, and this would be close to some of that seed planting that we'd be doing a little bit further up in those areas. But this is an area that's been worked pretty heavily when Those areas were open, and the shell in this area has gotten pretty low.
That's in 7, right?
Yes, yep. Again, Piankatank, we would probably do a little bit of shell planting there on the seed and some of the sanctuary areas there. This could be done with restoration work, restoration funds. And then we would try to get some shell there on Beverly's and Deep Rock, the Patentong areas there. And again, you know, mobilization costs will hopefully mean the per unit cost for both of these when you're combining replenishment and restoration funds will be lower, so we'll get more shell overboard for a lower price. York River, we did plant this area last year. Timberneck is about to be open to hand scrape. It was open to hand tong in November this year. There were about 20 to 30 boats out there doing quite well, is my understanding. I actually took my son out there. He's 2, and he got to say hi to some folks there on one of the days off we had this year. He got a kick out of seeing the hand tongers out there working in Timberneck. But this area will be replanted. It's one of the deeper areas in the York River, Aberdeen and Pages. As you go further up, those areas do get shallower and hard to replenish, but we were able to get some shell up there last year, and this area did get a very, very good spat set for the York River last year. Sarah's Creek, these are new shell plants. These areas were restored with used restoration money last year, and again, we were able to get the per unit cost down for both areas by sort of combining this, and we're going to be in the neighborhood there next year. And these areas would be planted with restoration funds as part of that Bay program. And this is a harvest area that would be planted using replenishment general funds.
Andrew, on the York River, y'all are aware that Cyrus Creek, that area there, is up for a NOAA, historical site?
Yeah.
And that looks like it's awful close to it.
Yeah, no, we all of our shell permitting site goes through core permit authorization, and most of the historic shipwrecks are on the southern side there. So that's where Cornwallis sunk his fleet because he didn't want the...
I've been to a couple meetings on it, and it's from one side of the river to the other side of the river, above the bridge and below the bridge. That's what you're talking about.
Yeah, no, we've been in coordination with the Department of Historic Resources and those folks over there to make sure that we're not getting anybody's way there.
Right where your marker is right now, there was a lot of moisture caught there the last time I worked up there. A little bit closer to the Gloucester side.
Yeah.
So down towards the bridge, right along in there, to the right a little bit, yeah. A lot of guys worked up in there when the wind was to the north, and I never did work in there, but there's a lot of boats up in there, so I know they caught some.
Okay.
Yeah. So I know it's a rock in there.
Yeah.
I'd be wearing that because, something's going to change there.
So, next month.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But the hand tong was pretty much cleaned that place up, didn't Andrew?
No, we actually resurveyed it after the hand tong.
Think it's enough to dredge on
it? Yeah, no, it, I mean... Unless we were hitting every spot that they didn't, it looked like it'll still be a pretty. It doesn't look like there's been a dredge there. So I mean, the difference between an area that's been hand tonged for a month worth of scraped is. We're going to go out and again resurvey that area after the hand scrape, so we should have good information on what a month of hand tonging did there and what a month of hand scraping did there for future discussions down the road.
The only thing I can say, be prepared for a lot of pressure there because James River closes next week and they're going to all be right there.
No, we've heard that a lot of folks are going to be headed that
way. It ain't going to stand a week.
I ain't going to be there.
Andrew, I would like to say something whenever I get a giant.
Yeah, go ahead.
I heard you talking about planting that seed. I take it like up on Irie at 9 or 10, at the Pocono. Sounded like that's what you were talking about. I'm not what you call in favor of that. I think it needs to be down to sign further. It's too close to the Maryland line. We have too much of an issue dealing with those oysters a few years ago. Right now it's not an issue because all the oysters in Maryland's up around New Law.
it's going to come a, it's going to come a challenge that, you know, they could be back down in the Pocomoke again. And I think Don and Bill Bailey and all, I think they're kind of in agreement too. I'm sure you're talking to them that that city just will die further. I mean, now where you're planting the shells on Bird Rock or down on Marshall, that would be, you know, a pretty good place to put them. And then I heard you talking about putting shells on Parker's. I'm about ready to write Parker's off. I can only speak for me, but I would say it was like back in 03 or 04 or 05, Tommy and Rufus, Jerry, and there were another, Yasky, Ron Yasky, run the greatest amount of shells you've ever seen in your life, the Parker's. And you go there now, and it's, I mean, there's not been any amount of work there. It's not like it's been work hard. It's hard. I mean, it's a hard place to get going. And I think them shells would be better off planted somewhere else. I think we're got to the point, Colin, that the shells, the way it signs, the shells could get, and the money could get, we need to start putting the money where things is working. And Parker, for some reason, just ain't doing it. I don't know how many shells Tommy and all put there. He might be able to come up with you, but I've heard Jerry say how many loads he put there. It was a ton. And right at the same time, they put that many shells on the inside of the alley. And they were just as many oysters in my head as they were on the inside of the alley. Well, now when the alley's open, that's where they're in California, that's where everybody is. And it was the same shell, planted at the same time. It's just something about Parker's that will not get going. And I just think, if you look at it as if this was your business, if this was my money, if this was, you know, any of our money, there's times you just have to cut your losses and move on. And I think putting seed up in the Saxon area is too risky. And I think Parker's is just, I think it's just time to move on from Parker's.
Well, I guess I did talk to Don there. I think he was trying to make it there, but I'm not sure if he might have gone out today and wasn't sure if he was going to make it back there. And I think part of his concern was the poaching there in the Pocomoke Sound with the seed. And I mean, the reason for moving seed, really, it's expensive for one, and we try to move it to areas that haven't gotten a good spat set. So it's not just to create a harvest area that's better because we move seed there. It's to take an area that really isn't going to be a harvest area unless we put seed there. So Bird, Marshalls, and those areas, I mean, they did get a pretty good spat set this last year, and we can plant those areas with shell and hopefully get a good spat set again there. So, I mean, I could be convinced that might not be the best use to put seed there for those concerns. But the other issue there is that we did plant shell there in the Pocomoke, upper Pocomoke area there, and it hasn't gotten a set. So it's one of those we can spend, you know, $50,000 again to potentially recoup, $200,000 investment on shell in those areas. So it's one of those difficult decisions in terms of where to move seed, but we can tell you that there hasn't been a good spat set in the upper Pocomoke Sound since most of the live oysters have left there via various means, including opening those areas up to harvest. So that's sort of the reason for putting it there. And taking into account what you've said there, you know, this area is the closest to Saxis Harbor there, the furthest from the Maryland line, and is probably, they'd have to be right there off the shore, basically. And I know they could be, but it would be, it's probably one of the safer areas there, at least in terms of the Maryland side of things, to put seed. It's also an area directly where we'd be putting it is some of the shallower areas where we can't get a larger shell planting barge onto. Similar to some of the other areas that we do put seed on in the Potomac Tribs. So it would be an area of getting shell onto an area that historically has been more productive. But I do hear your concerns, and if the other committee members have any comments on that, I'd be glad to hear those as well.
Could you pull that back up, the pinpoint the areas that Dan's talking about?
So these are, this is area 10 here, sort of this area here. This is area 9. So these are the two areas of area 9. And this is the area, this is Somerset County, Maryland there. And this is the area closest, furthest away from the line that's relatively shallow that we would propose putting seed on. So I'm not sure if, you know, North End Point there, Dan, but Robin Hood Bay where that hook is, it's the rock there closest to Saxis Island, basically.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to stop them. I mean, I really don't. I also, here's another concern, Tom, with these areas. These areas don't even have a rotation. You know, that hasn't been open in years. And I know you'll sit here and give the argument that there's been no spat, there's been no, you know, this, that, or the other, and I understand that, but there's places that open that has very low spats yet, and it's still open. I think one of them was open, what, 2 or 3 years ago, something like that, and it weren't great, but, I mean, there's no steady rotation on these two places, and to put seed in an area that there's no steady rotation, that there's a chance that there could be poaching, and I just don't think that's the logical place to put seed. If you didn't want to put it on Bird Rock or Marshall, there's another rock down below that has it's got a very good base. I could give you numbers for it. Mm-hmm. And that's what you're enhancing to see. You know, it's not a whole lot of market oysters on. It's called Island Rock. That's below Bird Rock a ways, a couple miles. And it's in this year, you know, it's in this year's rotation. So it'd be closed next year. But I don't know. It's just, there's too many variables. There's too many red flags to me to put seed, to spend money on seed in a place, you know, that vulnerable. Not only, and then you take like last year with all the fresh water, that had the same effects as the rivers had. Or, you know, they put a sign in like right behind it, what's going on up there with people frog grind, this, that, and the other. I just think there's too many red flags to be spending money on seed up there.
Does the committee have any comments on this? I mean, if I could say something, you know. Dan, you know, he works here. He knows this area very well. And, you know, there have been a lot of issues with poaching up in these areas.
Mm-hmm.
And we can put oysters on this area, small seed oysters, and we can close it, but it's not going to stop poachers from coming there. You know, I think we could come up with a better alternative. Maybe just take a look at this area that Dan's talking about.
Well, I think that we could scratch that particular seed plant if it sounds like there's still some heartburn about it, and that money isn't necessarily going anywhere. That's user fee money that we'd be paying for this. So we can either look at a different area this year, or look at more seed planting in a future year if we don't get a spat set again this year. But those areas in the lower Pocomoke Sound, we've been able to replenish those areas with shell. I hear you on Parker's there too, Dan. So that's one of those areas that given the funding stream, we might trim some of those acreages out of there, and Parker's may be an area if we put a minimum amount of shell based on your input and other needs in areas that are more productive. So that's just so you're aware that I know I mentioned Parker's. Those are areas that are needed shell based on our survey. But the areas that have been more productive and have been worked more would be the priority areas there. So Bird, Marshalls, and California and Thoroughfare, for sure.
How about this area Dan's talking about? How much trouble is it to check something like that out?
We can check that area out, see what's there. But again, that area, if it's deep enough, may be more cost effective in that area to plant some shell there rather than seed. I mean,
either way, you know, If you miss a year's planting, then you're a year behind, and I hate to see them, you know, miss that chance and put us a year behind over there. So maybe we can find something.
Yeah. Well, also keep in mind this seed is going to be relatively similar to if you did get a good spat set there, in terms of size wise. So it's not like that James River seed that's got multiple year classes mixed in there. So
I understand. Yeah. Any other comments, Dan?
I would like to make one real quick.
No.
To sit here on this committee, every year we do this and every year suggestions are made, and every year we are told why you're right and someone who's worked there their entire life is wrong. And I don't see the point of spending 2 hours coming here to do this to have our opinions and our knowledge. Everyone here is successful in their own piece of this industry, to just come say, sure, looks like a good plan, see you later. It's extremely frustrating and serves no point as a committee if every suggestion you're going to be told you're wrong or your idea is better than what someone else is putting forward. And that's all I got to say about that.
Well, I'll just say that in response to that I don't try to say my idea is any better than anyone else's.
There hasn't been a single suggestion made that you didn't say what was wrong with it or why it could not be done.
Well, I try to have it.
You're simply talking about moving several miles down the sound. It's actually less distance for the boat to travel.
And the way I understood it, I thought we were going to look into that. I thought we were going to check that place out and see what our alternatives were. I thought we understand.
Make a motion to do what Dan wants to have done.
Well, I think we still need to check this place out and see if it is worthy of what we need to do first. I mean, the place that was suggested
make
to start off might be.
Make it just that way.
No, that's not my... the chairman doesn't make a motion.
Can I ask a question, please?
Why did you pick those two areas? Just because of the how much shell it is per meter, or is there any more that you can, kind of back up of why you're thinking about those two?
Well, after talking to Dan and Don and many of the other folks and this committee, and based on the survey information that there aren't very many live oysters in these areas, this is an area that we'd like to get on a rotation schedule. But the reason it's not on a rotation schedule is it hasn't gotten up to an area where it could be. So this is an area that hasn't seen recruitment. It's hard to plant with large shells, large shell planting barges. It's the furthest away from the Maryland line. Based on input from this committee and what we've seen in the past, transporting seed to an area, shell rock, when we did it with the Great Wicomico seed, that rejuvenated that area. After some shell planting, we've done that again this last year with seed, and that area has started to recover. I'm not saying it's a cause and effect, but the intent is to keep doing what we've been doing that's worked based on the valuable input of all these committee members and folks like Dan, and try it again this year. And I think, Mr. Chairman, you are correct that the reason we bring it here is for that, and so those concerns can be addressed, and staff will try to look at those concerns. And as we did last year, and as we do every year, make adjustments based on the input of this committee.
Dan, I have a question. These areas that we're talking about, are they subject to poaching up there?
I didn't hear you real good. Could you repeat it, please?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Are these areas that we've been talking about, putting shell or seed up in these areas, are they subject to poaching?
Yeah. I mean, very much so. I can visualize where Andrew's telling me, where they were thinking about putting it. That is further away from the line, but it you're getting into. I'll tell you, for instance, I don't know if it's still up there. There used to be a mooring buoy up there for the tugboat that went up to Pocono City, and he would, he would just transfer the dollars to one of these mooring buoys. Well, that was in Virginia a pretty good ways. And I heard a guy right out of his own mouth say that he would make a circle around that mooring buoy if a tug was calling to it to make sure law enforcement weren't behind it.
before he'd let it dry up. And like I said, right now there's no problem with it. There's been no oysters there. But it's just, and I'll say this too, I mean, look, if any of you read any of the news all summer long, they weren't all Marylanders. They caught somebody right out of dire. So let's put it away from, I think we need to put the seed further away. I mean, let's put it down some. If you know, like with down there in the Allen Rock, it's very vulnerable to poaching, it's very vulnerable to freshwater. I would love to be able to put it up there and make it grow and make it get started again, but I don't know that it's going to get a chance. I mean, I really don't.
Another question? Yes, go ahead.
When's the last time those areas were open?
Area 10 was open in the 18-19 season there, so 2018. Area 9, I believe, 2 years before that. So.
Do you need a motion to move it down to Sands and not put up on that? Do it.
Well, yeah, you can go ahead and I mean, we can make that motion, or we could sort of, I could make that adjustment when we do the whole plan, or we could sort of chop it out. It's up to
What can you give us an idea maybe what your adjustment would be?
I could say that we could look at those areas that Dan proposed, or address not moving any seed there. We could put that into more shell on bird marshals. So we could save that decision and basically strike that from the plan, that 5,000 bushels there, or look at an alternative site in the Pocomo. So we could look at doing that.
I think you should get whatever you're going to plan up there somewhere else, but I don't think you should take it from them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever you do. I just make a motion that you don't put in the seed up there and to move it down the river or put it somewhere else. Like Dan says,
but those places you're talking about, what are the distance from the Maryland line? Are they like a couple miles?
Very far.
Across the street.
well, this is area 9 there. This is the rock that's right up on the line. This is that area, Bowie Rock, that is closest to the line, both are circling. But this is probably about half a mile, so it's about a quarter of a mile from the line or so.
Wow.
Dan, make a motion where you want them to be, and I'll second.
I would just like to get Donald on here.
We already have a motion.
Getting together and coming up with, you know, getting together with one or two of them and thinking, I think Don will be all right with Allen Rock. You know, let's move it down some. I would like to just maybe make a motion to table this so that Don can be on here at the next meeting if that's how it's got to be. But I don't think the city needs to go up there. I think it's just... Again, I keep looking at this if it was my business. I would not put money up there. I mean, not that kind of money. I you know, your foot shells, it's not producing. Andrew, if I'm not mistaken, you told me you put this seed out of shell rock last year, and not only is the seed doing good, but I think I remember you saying this, it got a stripe on top of the seed. So, why gamble with this kind of money, with everybody's livelihood? I would like to at least table it. Though, you know, maybe me, you, and Don, and Bill, or you know, whoever could come up with something better.
When does this proposal have to go before the commission?
This is in February meeting, so there's more than a month now that we could table that for now.
We can table that for now.
Can't you make a motion that Don and get together?
Well, if we table it, we don't have to make a motion on it until we revisit it and discuss it.
Does that mean
we can vote on it now? They can decide what they want.
I would be willing to make a motion for a subcommittee that, I guess, at the end when your full motion comes up, that to support.
I think that would be a good way forward, is we can take a look at where the seed goes. I mean, this is one of those that's done with user fees, so we do want your input, particularly on where this is going, as a lot of that money is coming from the harvesters there, particularly for the seed. So if that's, I think that that's a good way forward there in terms of.
I understand. We understand what you're trying to do, but I also understand what Dan's talking about when he's talking about he's scared to put stuff on this area that may benefit somebody that we don't want it to benefit. And I certainly think that we can get more people from this area that are a whole lot more familiar with what's going on and get them with you and work out a plan where we can come up with something that I think is more suitable. And we had somebody in the audience.
I had a question about the seeds. The James River seeds you're talking about moving, is that going to be hand-hung or is that going to be dredged off of Nansman like it was last year?
Most likely dredged off Nansman like it was last year.
I mean, my concern and my question is, do we really think we're going to get to 20,000 bushels? If we need to cut some, would we cut that? You know, if we don't get to that 20,000 number, that's a big number to come off of Nansman.
Yeah, no, it likely would be up to that 20,000 amount. So I think last year we did a little less than the full amount.
Yeah, that's
there, so
kind of what I'm thinking might happen this year. I was wanting to know hand tone wise, you know, because the dollar amount of what you pay, the waterman side, oh, we're not going to do it. Then we don't get done. No seed at all.
Yeah, yeah.
So before you make a motion, I think you need to decide where you want to cut seed from if we don't come up with the full amount of seed. All these areas,
Nomini. The way that we tried to split it up last year was try to do a proportional cut. So if it didn't look like we were going to be able to get the full amount, try to proportionally cut it.
Everybody get a little less.
Right.
Understood. Dan, was that suitable to you to table this and have more discussion from people in your area about what might be best?
Yeah, I'll be fine with that. I mean, if Andrew wanted to set up a conference call, you know, like with me, Don, and, you know, Don wanted to get a few more over there, you know, with input, I'd be fine with that. I don't claim to know all the answers, but I don't think that's the answer. I really don't.
I think that's a good way forward there, so we can table that particular portion of the seed planning and send it to a subcommittee.
And then, maybe you could.
I mean, just, you know, you probably could do it just like we're doing, like I'm doing now. Just email me, Don, the number I drew. I mean, if it ain't got to be a special date, just whenever you get a chance, I'm usually home most every evening, so.
And maybe you could get somebody else on there, like Tommy or somebody that, a couple of people from this committee and form a subcommittee and discuss this, and then you could shoot the whole committee an email and let us know what's going on.
Yep. We can do that.
That's
all right. I know we're getting on towards 6 o'clock there, a little after, but I'll try to get through the rest of this and then try to take it at the end. Any other questions there? So off seed, I think we finished shell plant. The last place we stopped off was James River, and again, this area had over 500 acres proposed. We'll likely trim a good portion of that, but the areas that we focused at work on will be portions of Upper Thomas, Upper Brown, Lower Brown Shoals. And again, just so everyone's aware, the area that we've been removing the seed from is just this small little piece of Nansman Ridge. So the majority of that area hasn't been having any of this seed removed. It's just from about 20 to now 40 acres or so that we've planted heavily with shell for this purpose because it's been getting consistent good spat sets there. And there were relatively low numbers of market oysters there. So the good news is that the last 2-3 years, the rest of Nansman Ridge that we haven't been doing this program has gotten a little bit of shell planting as well and seen good recruitment. And this area is really starting to produce again. But again, we plant this area, portion of this, it's, you know, 200 some plus acres, and again the areas that we're removing this seed if we do that program this year to transport to other areas.
Yeah, so, the production we get from that area, I don't see how we cannot.
This is a similar program that other states, Maryland has done with their reshell planting program, is they would plant in high recruitment areas and then transport that seed to other areas in the state. But this would be the area that we'd look at for doing again this year in the Lower James. And we can also plant fossil shell, reef shell there at the lowest price that we can get, because we're basically removing it from that shell deposit very close by, so we can plant shell there relatively cheaply too. So that's primarily the shell planting in the bay and main tributaries there. On the seaside of the Eastern Shore, this is primarily TNC funding and some general funds from restoration. We may be able to use some of that capital fund large dollar amount, but again, that dollar amount is a little uncertain at this time. Again, in the past, TNC has actually been able to do some replenishment work on areas open to hand harvest on the seaside. This is actually one of the joint VMRC TNC sanctuaries on the seaside of the Eastern Shore, and you can see there's a number of adjacent public rocks there that are open to harvest. So we probably do a combination of closed areas and harvest areas there in the seaside of the Eastern Shore.
Are they all hand harvest areas?
The way regulation currently is, anything that's intertidal is hand harvest, and if it doesn't ebb out, which is very, very limited areas on the seaside, then that area can be harvested with hand tongs or shaft tongs. Again, this is, if you look there, where the bulk of that general funds for restoration specific and the capital funds and the other settlements funding would be spent is mostly on alternative substrate projects. So these are usually a combination of crushed stone, crushed concrete, in various sizes depending on the area, but it's basically the largest size that you can wash overboard using high pressure water hoses on closed harvest areas, and on areas that are open to harvest. We've sort of dialed in on an ideal size for harvest areas, particularly if they're open to scrape or dredge. Some of the original size stone, number one VDOT or number three VDOT, depending on how it grades, it's a little bit of variable stone size, but that was a little bit too large, and in the harvesting process, some of the oysters were damaged. But we've dialed in on sort of a smaller size for harvest areas. Most of these areas, you want a little bit firmer sand in your bottom. They don't do quite as well as shell and mud. Stone's heavier, it sinks. But we've gotten pretty good at choosing these alternative substrate sites. But the areas that would be open to harvest, and these are more of a maybe, if funding allows and we're in the area and we can do some alternative substrate planting on harvest areas. The harvest areas would be Chesapeake Bay Deep Rock. There's already permitted sites there from past years that if we're in the area, we can do some stone planting on. There's two areas in the lower Rappahannock rotations that we have existing permits on. And there's an existing permit on the Nansman Ridge. This is probably the biggest maybe area there. We're already going to be in that area primarily with fossil shells. But if something happens and we're not able to plant fossil shells, we'd like to have these areas permitted for alternative substrate planting, if that's one of the alternatives that we have to use.
Yeah, substrate, how effective is that in getting spat compared to shell?
It is very effective. So it as much room as you can cover in spat on what we've seen is covered in spat.
They should struggle on that as they should shell.
Yep, in okay. Most cases. They like it. There's not. It's really popular in the Gulf states on some of their harvest areas. They plant that sort of number 57 stone chips in the Rappahannock. Some of the areas have been recently open to harvest, and they've done pretty well. And what we've seen in the restoration areas, it gets pretty well wrapped up if it's in the right area. The Pocomoke Sound State Line. This is one of those areas where we've had this portion put in the plan for a couple of years. There was permitting delays the first year, and there was staffing shortages. We had some injuries last year that prevented this project from happening, but this was proposed and relieving in this plan this year. There's probably going to be funding available to get it done. We'd like to, if we can. This would give perhaps an alternative other than planting seed of an area, a way of creating a sanctuary area in the Pocomoke Sound that might boost those shell plants that we've done there that we could use restoration funds for. But I'll get into that in a little bit more detail. Further there, Elizabeth River, Eastern Branch, this would be alternative substrate, primarily with that DEQ funds, and the Piankatank River would be mostly general funds for restoration and a good portion of the NOAA grant funding would go into this area, as well as the any capital funds could be spent in restoration of the Piankatank. It's one of the tributaries that's been selected by Bay Program folks and partners for this large-scale restoration effort that Virginia is a signatory on. So again, this is there, that state line. These areas were cleaned in 2018 with ordinary dredges of live shell and oysters, and those shells were transported further into Virginia. So these areas, there's nothing there right now. Those were the infamous cross-border areas where people were circling on both sides. So these would be the areas where we proposed putting any of that alternative substrate, large-size stone there, if funding and staff time allows. These are the permitted sites in the Chesapeake Bay near Deep Rock. Again, these are pretty large polygons. They obviously wouldn't all be planted, but a small portion of them could be planted if we need to or if funding allows them or in the area. This is an area that's been planted in the past in the lower Rappahannock near Butler's Hole that we could expand in terms of the harvest area. And again, area two, Sturgeon's Bar, this area was being worked actually this year. And this is one of the areas where folks were still doing okay working on the stone that was planted there recently, just a little bit off that edge, off the main bars. And the advantage of stone is when it's worked with scrapes or dredges, it doesn't crumble and degrade quite as quickly as shell can, so it sticks around a little bit longer. So this is a possible area there in the Rappahannock that's harvest. Lower James is an area that permit. Again, this is an area that will probably most likely not be planted with stone, but we'd like to have it available and permitted if we need to plant stone there if something happens with our shell planting program. So wanted to make folks aware of that. Eastern Branch Elizabeth River, this is primarily going to be done with that DEQ settlement, no pun intended, but this is sort of a set in stone project. It was part of a much larger multi-million dollar settlement that DEQ reached with the Department of Navy and Atlantic Wood, and there was a mitigation component, and the powers that be chose oyster restoration, and PMRC was fortunate enough to be able to receive these funds and can contract for this project. And this would primarily be done with alternative stone planting. And there is a possibility that we may be able to use some of the fine shells that are sort of a byproduct of the reef shell operation there. They're actually offloaded and purchased by the contractor right here in the Elizabeth River, so there's going to be barges of those fine shells going by. We may be able to do a portion of that project, sort of build a little bit of a base with those and plant lower amounts, less tonnage of stone on top of that sort of fine shell base, and again, hopefully bring down the cost of the overall shell planting by incorporating some of that work with that contract there. This is a larger area in the Piankatank. Again, it's not likely that all of these areas would be planted with stone, but these are sort of adjacent to our existing seed reefs that are primarily planted with shell, and this would sort of expand the footprint part of that large-scale restoration program. We planted approximately 47 acres of these areas last year with stone, and actually did receive a pretty good spat set. So again, it's sort of perfecting our toolbox for work in replenishment areas. And, you know, there's a good possibility that a lot of the spat set that was seen on Deep Rock, which I know there was a lot of death out there, but there was also a phenomenal spat set. Yeah. So there is a possibility that some of that may be coming from this area. And again, whenever possible, we'll try to bring the per unit cost down when we're doing this restoration work.
Andrew?
Yes?
Do you survey the TMC Fish and Bay Reef when you do?
We do, yes. Yeah.
How does that look after?
There are areas that look okay, and part of the problem is that area is very steep, so there are areas where it's sort of fallen away. It's right on that sort of steep edge. So it got a phenomenal spat set the first 2 years. I think it was planted last time in 2014. It's not there are areas, parts of it that are holding up, and there's parts of it that have sort of rolled down that edge a little bit there. So it's mixed success, I would say, that Fishing Bay area. It's one of those that you try to hit that sort of transition between sand and mud, and there are areas in the beginning tank where it's a pretty steep transition. So it's not always ideal, but there is a pretty good ribbon in a lot of these areas where there's still a existing spot. And that covers the proposed replenishment restoration work for 2020. I'd be glad to take any input, answer any questions.
Any questions or comments on this plan?
What's the proposed total acreage for altering the substrate for the game tank?
Right now, if we were to do all the permitted areas, it would be approximately 114 acres. I'm not sure we'll be able to do that all in a single year.
All of those polygons are permitted already?
No, these are just the permitted areas. So this is much larger acreage than that, but that would be the maximum acreage we'd plant, would be 114 acres. Usually for permitting purposes, we like to try to do a great big polygon, sort of carve out the best areas within that, and then survey those areas. But it would be a maximum of 114 acres would be what PMRC would do, not likely next year entirely, but next 2 or 3 years. But a minimum, I would say, of 30 to 50 acres next year.
Anyone else?
So, Mr. Button, would it be good to have a motion from this committee to move this forward to the commission?
It would be helpful to have a motion to either approve the plan as amended or any other additions coming forward there.
We work on motions and passing them, so somebody have to make a motion.
Does that leave the Dan's area open?
Yes, that would just be tabled until
I'll totally take it to the commission. If SMAC doesn't want to make a motion for approval or disapproval,
I'll make a motion that we approve everything but the portion that you want to table to talk to Dan, the guys around Saxis.
Okay, so just to be clear, a motion to approve the plan as presented with the amendment of the 5,000 bushels in Upper Pocomoke, forming a subcommittee and readdressing at a later date. Okay.
We have a second. More discussion? Well, I tell you, I don't think I can vote for this plan as it stands. I mean, like my thoughts earlier were, I just don't think that the watermen are getting a fair share of this money. I think if it was more equitable on the replenishment side as opposed to the restoration side, I could see where we're getting our fair share of it. But as it stands here, I don't see where the watermen are going to come ahead on this deal. So. I plan to not vote for it. So.
And I need to disclose an inherent conflict of interest and would abstain from a vote and have to abstain from making a motion or second.
All right, if there is no second, I guess we will just let Mr. Benton take his plan to the commission.
I can't hear real good. Has this been seconded?
No, it hasn't.
Did I?
No, it hasn't. Not yet.
I'll second it.
We have a second. And the motion is to pass this plan except for the planting of seed in Pocomoke that's been tabled and until it can be looked at by a subcommittee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
Aye.
We have 3 aye.
So can we do a roll call there on that?
Let me go back. All those that were in favor, raise your hand, please. 1, 2, 3, 4. 4. Okay. 4 in favor. All opposed?
2. I'm going to abstain.
2 opposed, 1 abstention. So the motion passed.
Abstain.
2 abstentions, I'm sorry.
So you're due to a conflict of interest.
Yes, ma'am.
And Dan, were you?
Abstain.
Yeah,
2
abstentions.
Okay.
So you
had
4.
So 4 opposed,
2? 2 abstentions.
Okay. And how many opposed there?
2.
2. Okay. And Dan, were you counted on that one?
Yeah, well, I didn't know if I needed to or I seconded. Yeah.
So are you 4 then?
Yeah, 4.
Okay, so that's 5. Okay. 5, 4, 2 abstentions, 2 opposed. Okay.
That's
wrong
for a loop.
All right, the motion passes. Do we have any other business, Mr. Buck?
I know it's getting late there, and we can save that for another SMAC meeting. But I think Mr. Hudgens there, you'd asked about some information regarding harvest effort and looking at reinvesting the 20 days in order to transfer a license. I know I've talked to some folks individually about that. That might be a better discussion, save for when we get to the harvest season.
Yeah, I can wait. That's fine. I'd like to get a few more numbers anyway before I do it.
Yeah. So. I can send you this information there again, okay. But just so everyone's aware, this is sort of the number of user fees in 2018. Okay. This was the number, so 900 was the number of people. It's about the same in 2019. It's come down maybe 10 or 15. This was the number of people reporting harvest in 2018, 466. And of those 466, 427 were eligible to transfer, that they had at least 40 days.
Okay. The difference between 427 and 466 is that the people that are kind of sitting on the sideline not reporting?
No, this is at 900. So those are all those folks that are eligible. So there's almost 500 people that aren't doing anything
at
all. Right. And this is people that are just doing some.
So
and
that's
this is, yeah, yeah. But that 427 is.
Okay. That's half. That's a big number. That's half of it.
Before we adjourn, I think just one point that not necessarily you, staff, or the commission has the ability to change those restoration dollars around. That comes
from... General Assembly, yeah.
So, the General Assembly is still in session, so you can still reach out for that capital piece and... make a recommendation that a small part or whatever could be used for replenishment as opposed to restoration. But it's not that Andrew's decided that we're going
to... I realize that. I'm not taking that on him, but I just think it was very disproportionate.
Well, I agree. Yeah. But just in fairness, it's not...
Yep.
Any other questions, comments? If not, I need a motion to adjourn.
Move.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you all for coming. It is hard. I'm just trying to let everyone know what's going on. And I mean, Tommy's right that a lot of that isn't. Don't shoot the messenger. I hit this record now. Oh.
I mean, with the seed, it's one of those types of things. But I think cocktails are a good spot for it. Or, I mean, put it in the more shallow.